tourists are on Israeli soil. Holy shit, Peter said. How'd that go?
About as well as you'd expect. We danced around for a bit before they told me it would be best if my Israeli vacation came to an end.
Guess you didn't take their advice, Peter said. Jack nodded.
You could say that. Believe it or not, I had every intention of unassing this place. The last thing I wanted to do was to compromise you or your team.
But, Peter said, but I didn't see the harm in returning the kid's action figure on the way to the airport. Famous last words. Jack nodded again. I guess. I found the kid and his mom, but I also found Jet Li.
God damn, Peter said, shaking his head. Another go with the knife?
Gun this time. I stopped him from killing the mom, but before I could get my hands on him, a Zodiac extracted him.
What did you stumble into?
That's the question, Jack said, and one I still can't answer. The mom and kid were kidnapped on the way to the airport. Two Israelis were killed in the fray.
You've had a rough go of it, kid, Peter said,
scratching his bristly hair with a ham-sized hand.
But why are you here?
Not sure, Jack said. Frankly, I wasn't expecting you to still be in town. The asset validation exercise ended hours ago. That's plenty of time for you and your team to exfil.
But here you are.
Jack let the end of the sentence trail off as he watched the CIA operative, waiting. His answer to Peter had been truthful. Jack didn't know exactly why he was here. He'd tried to explain it away as a chance liaison with a U.S. operational team, or perhaps a mechanism for engaging the intelligence agency's considerable analytical capabilities. But neither of these explanations rang true. Jack was at the safe house because his gut told him this was the next rock he needed to turn over. Jack's instincts had become more refined over the years. At first, he'd resisted the idea of operating by his gut, but Ding had weighed in with the opposite perspective. Much like hours putting lead downrange and long sessions in the combatives annex perfected an operative's ability to fight and shoot, running surveillance detection routes, recruiting assets, and coordinating complex operations trained the mind. And not just the conscious portion. Like it or not, Jack's subconscious was along for the ride. This linked to a more primeval period of human history, when daily survival depended on a hunter-gatherer's ability to make split-second decisions, still lurked in the human brain. The primitive, evolutionary relic might be of little use to the modern cubicle dweller. But Jack didn't work in an office. As Ding had made clear, every good operator developed some sort of sixth sense, and Jack's had pointed him toward the CIA safe house. Now the body language emanating from the mountain of a man who was one of his mentor's oldest friends indicated that Jack's intuition had proven correct. Something else was going on here.
Chapter 29. Peter unwound his arms and steepled his fingers, chest level. This was known as the interview stance. It was commonly used by law enforcement personnel to keep their hands ready, even though their stance appeared to be non-confrontational. The key word was appeared. Jack resisted the urge to arrange his hands in a similar pose, but he did widen his stance and transfer his weight to the balls of his feet. He didn't know what was happening, but the building tension suggested it wasn't good. Yet again, he'd brought just his hands to a knife fight, or potentially a gunfight. He'd already survived both today. But even cats ran out of lives eventually.
Okay, Peter said, radiating nervous energy. Let me lay this on you. We aren't just here for an asset validation exercise.
You don't say, Jack said. He forced a smile while looking at the stocky operator, developing his own contingency plan. If Peter went for a gun, Jack was done. But if,
Like many operators, Peter's default close-in weapon was something sharp. Jack had a sliver of a chance. To employ a knife, Peter would have to close ground, potentially exposing his gimp leg. Jack pictured how this would go, imagining himself devastating Peter's wounded leg with a Muay Thai kick. It wasn't the best plan, but it would have to do. In no scenario did Jack intend to get into a grappling match with an armed man who outweighed him by at least 20 pounds.
"Sorry for the runaround," Peter said. "The validation exercise was for real, but it was also part of a deception plan. Something to divert the Mossad or Shin Bet while the other part of my team got after our real purpose."
"Which was?" Jack said. Jack edged to his right as he spoke, trying to move out of the corner into which Peter had herded him. Peter hadn't attempted to close the gap between them, but the paramilitary officer was still sparking like a live wire. Besides, in this case, distance was Jack's friend. Given Peter's size, there was a better than even chance the commando would absorb the kick and keep on coming. Taking out his leg wouldn't help if Peter got his meat hooks into Jack and dragged him to the floor.
"Did you get a good look at the knife man?" Peter said.
"I was close enough to smell what he had for lunch."
"Then you saw his nationality?"
Jack shrugged. "We didn't exactly exchange hellos, but I'd guess he was Asian."
"Chinese. The MSS.
"The Ministry of State Security?" Jack said. "You serious?"
"As a heart attack."
Jack frowned. He hadn't seen that one coming. Why would Chinese intelligence be interested in a woman and her son?
Not the son, the woman.
"How much do you know about her?" Jack shook his head.
"Not much more than her name.
Becca Schweigart." Peter seemed to relax at Jack's answer, hands drifting toward his waist. The CIA officer still felt twitchy, but Jack was no longer getting the vibe that he wanted to grab Jack's throat and start squeezing.
"Progress." "She was being modest," Peter said.
"Her name is Dr. Rebecca Schweigart."
"A doctor?" Jack said,
trying to reconcile the nervous wreck of a woman he'd led off the beach with his analytical, no-nonsense mother. Granted, not everyone was an accomplished surgeon like Kathy Ryan, but Jack still would have expected more from a doctor.
"Not a medical doctor," Peter said, seeing Jack's confusion. "Becca's a scientist. Her doctorate is in applied physics."
"Why is that important?" Jack said.
"Because she's the reason we're here."
"What do you know about Chinese industrial capabilities?"
"Enough to understand they're not our friends. The U.S. lobbied for the Chinese to be granted membership in the World Trade Organization back in the 90s. It was supposed to lead them down the path to capitalism. Instead, China's been buying, copying, bullying, or outright stealing intellectual property from other nations ever since. Far from normalizing the Chinese communists, the free trade nations have created an 800-pound gorilla with a buying power of 1.4 billion people. China's a disaster."
Peter's posture edged down another notch as he nodded along with Jack.
"That's right. The Chinese Communist Party has been siphoning off trade secrets for the last 30 years. Take their J-20 stealth fighter. They don't have the expertise required to manufacture a true fifth-generation fighter, but agency analysts believe that bird is a solid 4.5.
So tell me, how does a country make the exponential leap from a third-generation rattletrap to a fighter that flies circles around what most of our NATO allies can field?"
"Espionage," Jack said.
"That's half the answer," Peter said.
"The other half is scientists like your Dr. Schweigart. China has been flooding Western schools with graduate students who bring home U.S. technology by the bucket load. And what the Chinese students can't steal, the Chinese Communist Party acquires through grants to top universities and scientists. Hell, a recent FBI investigation found that dozens of hard science laboratories at the University of Texas were funded by Chinese dollars in the guise of talent recruitment plans. And that doesn't count the scientists who willingly work for the Chinese."
Jack felt his stomach sink. Does Becca?
We don't know, Peter said, cracking his giant knuckles. That's part of what we were trying to find out. Here's what we do know. Like many hotshot university professors, Becca founded a private laboratory affiliated with her university.
I thought professors were supposed to teach, Jack said.
Maybe if your specialty is English. But researchers in the hard sciences like Becca want a way to monetize their research. It's really a win-win for everyone. Professors get access to the university's talent pool and facilities while reaping the financial rewards of their research. Schools benefit from the buzz surrounding the innovative technology generated under their banner. A good laboratory is a huge recruiting tool for the university, and Becca's lab isn't just good. It's fantastic. The work she's doing out of a little school in Kansas has the boys and girls at MIT and Stanford all playing catch-up.
What work? Jack said.
Peter shook his head. My last science class was sophomore year of high school. Here's what I do know. Professor Schweigart's expertise lies in material science. Specifically, coatings capable of bonding to any material. Coatings that can be tuned to either scatter or transmit RF energy.
I studied history and economics, Jack said. Can you dumb that down for the liberal arts major?
Stealth in a bottle, Peter said. If our analysts are right, Beck has figured out a way to manufacture a spray-on coating that provides radar-defeating properties.
Holy shit, Jack said, as the gravity of Becca's discovery finally became clear. And she's selling this capability to the Chinese?
Not sure, Peter said. Sometimes scientists are willing participants and sometimes they're duped. Becca's been under surveillance since she arrived in country. The Chinese aren't stupid. We've been cracking down on their Confucius Institutes, so they know the American people are waking up to their blatant espionage. With this in mind, we've seen a shift in the way their case officers operate. Meetings between handler and asset are now held in countries not quite as concerned with countering the Chinese threat.
Like Israel, Jack said.
Peter shrugged. I've got nothing against the Israelis, but they aren't going to wade into a great power struggle between the U.S. and China. I'm not saying our Jewish friends are complicit, but I also don't think they give two shits if an MSS case officer meets with their American asset in Tel Aviv.
Jack thought about what Peter was implying. It made sense.
Like all nations, Israel was primarily concerned with its own survival. And though the United States and the Middle East's only democracy saw eye to eye on a wide range of issues, there had been some rough points in their relationship. The United States had even imposed sanctions for a period of time after Israel had sold armed drones to China. Still, much about what the CIA officer was suggesting didn't feel right. Take Becca herself. She had exhibited none of the self-awareness or street smarts of a trained asset. Instead, she'd behaved like a mom with her special needs son on a much-needed vacation. Then there was Tommy. While legendary operative Mary Pat Foley was famous for running joint intelligence operations with her husband while living behind the Iron Curtain, they were both farm-trained CIA case officers. And even then, Jack couldn't imagine Mary Pat endangering one of her children by using them as a prop. Becca was a scientist. Not an intelligence officer. She had none of Mary Pat's skills and all of her maternal instinct. Becca wouldn't knowingly put Tommy's life at risk.
But that wasn't all that was bothering Jack.
I hear you, Jack said, eyeing Peter. But if Becca is working for the Chinese, why did they try to kill her?
Jack had been careful to ask the question in as off-the-cuff a manner as possible. Even so, his words changed the room's dynamics. Once again, Jack could feel tension radiating from the operator like heat from a pot-bellied stove. Something was still simmering below the surface, and the pot was about to boil over.
Here's the thing, Peter said. We're in trouble.
We?
My team.
Where is your team, Peter? Jack said. Peter stared at Jack for a long moment. Jack kept his face carefully blank, but his heart was racing. Two teams hunting Becca, one who wanted her dead, one who wanted her alive. While it was true that the man who Jack had tangled with twice was Asian, Jack had no idea if he was really Chinese. What was also true was that Jack hadn't seen the faces of any of the other men. The Zodiac team had come and gone too fast for Jack to get a look, and the shooters who'd kidnapped Becca and Tommy had all been wearing masks. But the one Jack had unmasked hadn't been Asian. He'd been Caucasian. Just like Peter.
How well do you know Ding?
Peter said, breaking into Jack's thoughts. Pretty well, Jack said.
How well is pretty well?
Jack paused, considering how to answer. The question about Ding threw him off track. Peter was clearly nervous about something, and his behavior, combined with Jack's evolving hypothesis about Becca, didn't mix well. But if Peter and his team were the killers Jack was afraid they might be, why ask about Ding? Jack replayed the quick conversation he'd had with Ding prior to his departure for Israel. He couldn't remember the exact words his friend had used to describe his relationship with Peter, but he did recall one phrase verbatim. I vouch for Peter. In the clandestine community, the sentiment behind this sentence meant more than the words implied. Vouching for someone was the equivalent of saying that you could trust them with your life, that your honor was an extension of theirs, much like the mafiosi of old. Essentially, it meant that Jack should see Peter as Ding. What would Jack do if it were Ding asking him the question? Tell him the truth. Taking a breath, Jack put aside his suspicions and trusted Ding.
Domingo Chavez is my mentor, Jack said. We work in the same organization, and I owe him everything. When he asked me to take this assignment, he vouched for you. As far as I'm concerned, you are Ding.
Peter blew out a long breath, and the tension leaked from his body like air from a balloon.
Okay, kid, Peter said. I'm a little over my skis on this one.
I don't think Dr. Schweigart is a Chinese asset. At least, not anymore. Anymore? Jack said. Peter nodded. When she first came to Israel, we weren't sure. The FBI had been keeping an eye on her stateside for some time. They knew the Chinese were nosing around, but couldn't figure out if the MSS was gearing up for an initial approach or was already running her. Then she booked a trip to Israel. Which put her out of the Bureau's reach, Jack said. Peter nodded again.
Yep.
So the FBI passed the intelligence to the CIA. And who says fibbies and spooks don't get along? Peter smiled.
You might want to reserve judgment until you hear the rest of the story.
Anyway, the agency wasn't big on running an active surveillance mission in Israel because it's Israel, Jack said.
That's right.
When it comes to counter-espionage, the Israelis are ruthless. We knew they'd key in on a foreign team running an operation in their backyard.
So you gave them the asset validation exercise to focus on, Jack said. I get it.
But why not try and run a joint operation with the Shin Bet?
Good question, kid.
This is where things get sticky. Peter took out his cell, swiped a couple times, and then held up the handset for Jack to see.
Know this guy?
Jack looked at the screen and then slowly shook his head. The picture was of an unremarkable middle-aged man with muddy brown hair and dark eyes. Never seen him before in my life.
That's because he doesn't exist,
Peter said. Come again? Jack said. Dr. Schweigart isn't here on vacation. At least, not completely. Tel Aviv University is holding an academic conference in her area of specialization. Giant brains are flying in from all over the globe to attend. This guy's on the confirmed list, too. He runs a VC that invests in laboratories like the one Dr. Schweigart is forming. She's looking for investors, Jack said. Without a doubt. But I think her interest might be beyond just the professional. The hotel has in-room childcare, and she reserved a sitter for the night. She and this dashing captain of industry have plans to meet after the conference social. Peter made the statement in a matter-of-fact manner, but Jack still felt defensive on Becca's behalf. She's a grown woman, Jack said. Her business is her business. Couldn't agree more, Peter said. There's just one problem. This guy isn't who he says he is. What's that mean? Jack said. He doesn't actually run a VC? The technology fund he reps exists. In fact, it's made several investments in the work of scientists just like Dr. Schweigart. He's the shady part of the equation. In what way? Jack said. He's backstopped pretty well, but one of our desk jockeys graduated from the same MBA program this guy lists on his resume. The alumni network is pretty tight, so our guy put out some feelers. Nobody in Casanova's graduating class remembers him. Jack thought through the implications. He's an intelligence officer running a honey trap? That's my guess, Peter said. He's definitely not Asian, and he speaks English with an American accent. Jack studied the picture, considering. The man could pass for a number of different nationalities, including Israeli. You think he's Mossad? Jack said. Peter shrugged. Like I said, the Israelis are ruthless. But if the recruitment was happening on Israeli soil, it would probably be Shin Bet rather than the Mossad that made the approach. Regardless, if our mystery man is Israeli, there's no reason for him to impersonate an American. Plenty of VC funds in Tel Aviv looking to plow money into American startups. No, if I had to guess, this guy's another team's star player. We knew that the Chinese were interested in the good doctor. Word is they're working on their own version of the technology. I think the FBI was wrong, and Becca got pitched by the MSS back in the States. She either didn't know it or didn't report it. Either way, she must have turned them down. Now the Chinese want to take her off the table. And you used her as a dangle? Jack said, his blood pressure rising. To draw out the Chinese or anyone else interested in her? Brilliant. Right up until you sons of bitches lost her. Easy now, kid, Peter said. Was it a bad decision? Absolutely. And I take full responsibility for it. But we haven't lost her. At least, not completely. What do you mean? Jack said. We beaconed her. The device has extended life batteries and only transmits when it's interrogated. It's very hard to detect. How do you know she still has it? Jack said. If her captors are from an intelligence service, they'll search for the beacon. Even if they don't find it, they won't let her keep anything of her own. Not even her underwear. This isn't our first rodeo, kid, Peter said. Dr. Schweigart isn't the one carrying the beacon. Jack stared at Peter. The Captain America figure. You put your beacon in her autistic son's toy? Don't be getting all high and mighty, Peter said. A beacon isn't much good if the bad guys find it now, is it? We had to use something that she'd take everywhere. Then what are we waiting for? Jack said. Interrogate the beacon. Love to. The rest of my team's crawling all over Tel Aviv as we speak, but they haven't had any luck. Our best guess is that the beacon is out of range of our transmitters. Then she's gone, Jack said. Maybe not, Peter said. If we had some friends with a stronger transmitter... Oh, for fuck's sake, Jack said. You ran this operation without telling the Israelis, and now you want me to go to them for help? Like I said, kid, we're in trouble. Jack looked at Peter, thinking. The Israelis were going to be radioactive when they found out their suspicions about Jack were correct, even if he hadn't been in the know. Friendly nations ran undeclared intelligence operations on each other's soil all the time. The key was to give your allies plausible deniability by not fucking things up in the process. This little adventure was turning out to be a cluster of epic proportions. That aside, Becca and Tommy's lives were on the line. If Jack needed to go to the Israelis with his hat in his hand, so be it. "Okay," Jack said, "here's how it's going to work. Give me everything you've got on this mystery man who might just be a spy, as well as the beacon's info. I'll pay a visit to my Israeli friends, but this happened because of your team's fuck-up. You need to make things right."
"Ding vouched for me for a reason, kid," Peter said. "I don't need a reminder of what I owe to who. Find the girl and her son. If the Israelis get squeamish and you need some hitters, give me a ring. My boys and I will be ready." Jack was still pissed, but he nodded all the same. What's done was done. Scores could be settled later. Now he needed to focus on getting to the people who'd kidnapped Becca and Tommy before they slipped away. That was still a tall order, but at least now he had somewhere to start. And a phone call to make.
Chapter 30.
"Hello."
The voice on the other end of the cell phone radiated equal parts fatigue and anger. Jack understood, though he'd known the smiling Shin Bet agent for only a matter of hours. Tal had wormed her way into his heart. He couldn't imagine how her friends and comrades must feel, knowing that one-of-a-kind smile would never again warm up the room. "It's Jack," Jack said, holding the phone to his ear as he surveyed the road in front of him.
"Jack," Dudu said, the words sounding like gravel in his mouth. "I told you I would call you. And I told you I was going to find answers. I did."
"What?"
"In person," Jack said. "Pick me up. Corner of—" "I gave you that phone," Dudu said, the gruffness returning to his voice. "I know where you are. Walk west 2 blocks, then look for a silver taxi. Show them the address I'm texting. They will bring you to me."
It turned out "bring you to me" was an invitation to a place a bit more prestigious than the nondescript building where Jack had initially made his acquaintance with Tal and her beefier partner. The taxi deposited Jack in front of a building that virtually screamed government with a capital G. Cyclone fence topped with triple-strand barbed wire, roving guards, and cameras everywhere. If the previous site had been the Shin Bet's idea of flying under the radar, this building's purpose was to shout to the world that serious matters were decided inside its multi-story facade. To Jack's practiced eye, the structure in front of him looked like Israel's answer to the Hoover building. Bad guys beware. As he was trying to decide if he should make his way over to talk to the less-than-friendly-looking guard behind the bulletproof glass or just give Dudu another ring, the blast-proof metal door swung open and Dudu strode out.
"What do you have?" the Shin Bet man asked.
Once again, Jack felt that he was playing the role of troublesome asset more than operational partner, which was fine. He'd hardly given the Israeli much to go on, and the professional feeling of distrust between them was mutual. Still, Jack was smart enough to know that this was no longer his party. If he wanted to go to the dance, he needed to prove he was a worthwhile date.
"I can find her," Jack said.
"How?" Dudu said.
"She has a beacon," Jack said.
"Why?"
The moment of truth. Jack had been walking a tightrope since his first interaction with Tal and Dudu. From the beginning, the Shin Bet officers had seemed to know that he was more than just an American tourist. During their talk following Tal's death, Dudu had intimated as much again. Jack hadn't discouraged the Shin Bet agent's conclusions, but he hadn't confirmed them either. And there was a reason why. Jack worked for an intelligence organization not even officially acknowledged by his own government. He certainly couldn't come out to a foreign intelligence officer. And then there was Peter's team to consider. Sure,
The Shin Bet seemed to have Peter's men in its collective crosshairs, but thinking someone was a spy wasn't the same as knowing. That said, Jack wasn't a novice in the world of case officers and agents either. As the old field hands liked to say, you had to pay to play. Wanting to help find the people who'd killed Tal and kidnapped Becca and Tommy wouldn't be enough to gain entrance to the intimidating building. You had to pay to play. Becca's a person of interest to the U.S. government, Jack said, beginning the age-old dance practiced by espionage professionals since the dawn of time. Flirt enough to keep your suitor interested, but don't give away everything on the first date. Yes, yes, Dudu said, waving his hand for Jack to speak faster. We know she's a scientist, and that she was here to attend the academic conference. This is not news. Not just any scientist, Jack said. She's developed something novel in the material science realm. I've got a liberal arts degree, so I can't give you specifics, but my people are calling it stealth in a bottle. Jack was willing to bet that Dudu was an exceptional poker player. His face never changed expression, and neither did his eyes widen. The perfect blank stare. Almost. The fingers of Dudu's right hand, which until now had been urging Jack's story forward, froze. Jack had the Israeli's attention. Does she know about the beacon? Dudu said. Jack shook his head. No. She's unwitting. Why do this to her? Here again, Jack had to tread lightly. As much as people liked to romanticize otherwise, there were no true alliances between nations, only shared interests. Jack believed that he and Dudu both shared an interest in seeing Becca rescued and Tal's killers brought to justice. But if Becca's discovery really was that disruptive to current stealth technology, the interests of the United States and the sovereign nation of Israel might quickly diverge. Jack needed to ensure that didn't happen. We thought that she was being targeted by a foreign intelligence service, but we weren't sure. The FBI had been keeping tabs on her and her work. When she made plans to travel to Israel, responsibility for her passed to my organization. We beaconed her rather than running physical surveillance so as not to run the risk of alerting a counter-surveillance team. You wanted to use her to identify the service targeting her? Dudu said. That was the intent, Jack said. It didn't work out that way. If you'd just come to us, Dudu said, shaking his head. Maybe we should have. Jack said. But what's done is done. Here's what I know. Our scientist is gone, and Tal is dead. The question is, what are you and I going to do about it? Now you're ready for a joint operation, Dudu said, a flush creeping up his bull neck. After everything has gone to shit. I'm not talking about my government. I'm talking about me. I want to help. How? I'll give you the beacon, but I get to be part of the rescue operation. Why? Dudu said. The woman was captured on Israeli soil, and Israelis died protecting her. This is a problem for blue and white, not some American cowboy. At the word cowboy, Jack saw a smiling brunette with twin dimples. A smiling brunette now missing half of her face. With this image firmly in mind, Jack didn't have to work to bring the required hardness to his voice for what he said next. This is personal for me too, Dudu. I want to get Becca and her son back, but I also want to be there when the son of a bitch who killed Tal takes a round between the eyes. Dudu stared at Jack for a long moment, his face as expressionless as a slab of granite. Then he spoke. I think you may be part Israeli, Jack Ryan. Follow me, and for God's sake, touch nothing. Chapter 31. Jack had assumed the touch nothing instruction had been for dramatic effect. It wasn't. Dudu had been literally cautioning him to touch nothing inside the looming building, and it didn't take Jack long to discover why. From the time he'd entered the vestibule entranceway complete with a magnetometer, full-body scanner, and a couple other devices whose function Jack couldn't begin to fathom, he'd been approached no less than 3 times by employees attempting to gain a sample of his DNA. The first attempt had been pretty straightforward. A security person who'd buttonholed Jack with an outstretched swab and a smile on her face. Dudu had shot this down with a spat of Hebrew that, while incomprehensible, was unmistakable in its tone. The woman acquiesced with a frown, but the cunning look in her brown eyes said that this game was far from over. Next was an outstretched badge that Jack moved to take without thinking. Once again, Dudu intervened on his behalf, intercepting the plastic and clipping the badge to Jack's shirt himself. After that, Jack got the message. The folks here did not take kindly to visitors, and the visitors that did make an appearance probably gave false names. With that in mind, the Israelis were doing their damnedest to lock down the biometrics of their American guest, and Dudu was doing his level best to thwart their plan. Once again, Jack found himself revising his estimation of the Shin Bet agent. His initial assessment of Dudu as a knuckle-dragging pain in the ass still seemed to be correct, but Jack was now in the circle of trust. This meant that the former commando's belligerence was directed elsewhere. Jack remained silent throughout the initial encounters, content to let Dudu pull his weight. But once they crossed the marble foyer to a pair of elevators and the doors slid shut, Jack decided to break his silence. "What the hell?" Jack said, eyeing the Shin Bet officer. Dudu shrugged his massive shoulders. "We're Israeli. Espionage is in our blood. Touch nothing, and your cover should remain intact." "Should?" Jack said. Another shrug. "Like I said, we're Israeli." Dudu's silence after the last statement seemed to indicate that, as far as he was concerned, the issue was closed. But from Jack's perspective, the topic was a long way from being tabled. Jack had never been to Langley before, but he'd heard Ding talk about visiting Mary Pat at Langley when she'd still been an agency employee. While CIA security was robust, they drew the line at clandestine attempts to obtain a saliva sample. Jack didn't know how Dudu had explained his presence to the security personnel, but it certainly wasn't the standard liaison officer drill Jack would have used if their roles had been reversed. He was about to press the issue further when the elevator doors whisked open, revealing their destination. In spite of himself, Jack was impressed. When your father was the president of the United States, life did come with a few perks. One of those was seeing firsthand the famous government buildings that most people experienced only through books and movies. While Jack had found the executive residence to be a bit small for his taste, the 5,000-square-foot John F. Kennedy conference room, otherwise known as the Situation Room, more than lived up to the hype. In the decades after the September 11th attacks, the space had been completely retrofitted. Unlike the often stuffy air that accompanied the unglamorous workspaces in the West Wing, the Situation Room really did look like the command center for the most powerful man or woman on Earth. From the plush upholstered leather chairs that ringed the glossy brown table, the president and his staff could view live ISR footage from any sensor on the planet, watch in real time as Delta Force assaulters snatched a high-value target, and peer through an Apache helicopter's thermal sensor. From that basement bunker, admirals and generals could command and control the nation's fighting men and women almost down to the individual soldier level. It really was the equivalent of the bridge on the Starship Enterprise. But the Situation Room didn't hold a candle to where Jack now found himself. He was standing on a balcony overlooking a bullpen. Rows upon rows of desks were occupied by men and women wearing headsets and typing on computers. Additional people flitted from workstation to workstation like bees buzzing among flowers. Murmurs from dozens of muted conversations filled the air, but as impressive as the bullpen on the ground floor seemed, It was the front of the room that captured Jack's attention.
Three massive flat screens took up the entire wall, stretching from floor to ceiling. Hebrew characters adorned the top of each screen, which appeared to be displaying live feeds from orbiting aircraft or drones. Except the giant displays showed more than just predator porn. Like a widescreen TV's picture-in-picture, the UAV feed occupied only a small portion of the mammoth displays. The rest consisted of topical maps overlaid with operational graphics, link diagrams, and pop-up windows containing all manner of information. Jack didn't fully grasp what was being presented, but like a caveman stumbling across a spacecraft, he could tell that it was infinitely complex.
"Welcome," Dudu said, clearly enjoying Jack's reaction.
"What is this?" Jack said.
"Israel's nerve center. We based it on your own national counterterrorism center. Contrary to what the rest of the world believes, the decisions that govern the security of our nation aren't made in the Prime Minister's office or Mossad headquarters. They happen here."
Jack watched as windows on the gigantic screens opened and closed, cycling from topic to topic as the work product of countless analysts was displayed in real time.
"Who controls this?" Jack said.
"They do," Dudu said, gesturing over his shoulder.
Turning, Jack saw yet another level to the amphitheater. But unlike the bullpen, this tier was occupied by men and women in dresses and suits. The people in charge.
"What now?" Jack said.
"We talked to her," Dudu said, indicating a petite blonde with her hair pulled back in a bun, sitting at the edge of the platform. "If she agrees with your proposal, we get to work."
"And if she doesn't?" Jack said.
Another massive shrug. "Don't touch anything on the way out."
Chapter 32.
Jack followed Dudu up the winding open staircase leading to the amphitheater's second floor, trying to figure out how he was going to explain this to Ding at the inevitable post-mission debriefing. It wasn't so much that Jack was up to his eyeballs in trouble. That actually was par for the course. No, it was more of where Jack's adventures had landed him.
"So then my new Shin Bet friend took me into Israel's version of the NCTC.
Yep, that story was definitely going to need a little finessing. Fortunately, Jack was saved from that painful line of thought as he mounted the final step and came face to face with the diminutive blonde. Up close, Jack could see the woman was older than he'd first thought. Fine wrinkles webbed from her startlingly blue eyes, and streaks of gray accented her hair. Her mouth was ringed with laugh lines, which was a bit ironic, because nothing about her demeanor suggested that she was in a humorous mood.
"Who are you?" the woman said.
Her Slavic accent suggested that Israel was her adopted rather than birth home. This in itself was not unusual in a country in which fully a third of the population were once immigrants. Still, the way the woman was peering at Jack over the rim of her frameless glasses while perched on the edge of a backless stool suggested that she'd acclimated to her adopted country quite well. Jack felt like he was standing in front of a bird of prey sizing up its next meal. Dudu began to speak in Hebrew, no doubt attempting to answer her question, but the woman stopped him mid-sentence with a single upraised finger.
"I wasn't asking you," the woman said, never taking her eyes off Jack, "though we will have words later. I was asking him."
The emphasis she put on the word "him" put Jack in mind of a particularly repugnant insect.
"My name is Jack," Jack said. "I'm here to help you find the kidnapped American." Though he towered over the woman, he still had to fight the urge to fidget. In an instant, he understood why. He was facing off with the Israeli version of his mother.
"Of course you're here to help," the woman said. "Americans always want to help. Tell me, Jack the American, why do I need your help?"
"Ma'am," Jack said, putting a bit of steel into his voice,
Your setup here is very impressive. Probably the best I've ever seen, and believe me, that counts for something. But a friend of mine once said that the best technology in the world is worthless without human. From where I'm standing, you've got a lot of pretty lights, but jack shit when it comes to actionable intelligence. Dudu stiffened, but Jack ignored the Shin Bet agent. Diplomacy might have a time and place, but this wasn't it. A woman who knew the secret to stealth in a bottle and her little boy were in the hands of killers. Making nice with the Israelis would have to wait for later. This friend, the woman said, speaking each word with a surgeon's precision. What is his name? Her name is Mary Pat Foley, Jack said. Ring a bell? Perhaps, the woman said. She still watched Jack with an expressionless mask, but her gaze now seemed to hold more curiosity than annoyance. But even if I know that name, I don't know yours. Who are you? The man with the frequency that will activate the missing woman's beacon. Would you like it? Dudu muttered under his breath, but once again Jack ignored his friend. In for a penny, in for a pound. Give it to me, the woman said. Gladly, Jack said. As soon as you give me your word, I can accompany the team you send to extract her. Now the woman's thin lips did curve into a smile, but not the one Jack had been picturing. Why would I agree to this nonsense? Because that's my price, Jack said, and you're going to pay it. The woman's porcelain features flushed, her blue eyes glittering. She started to reply, but Jack interrupted her. I don't mean to be disrespectful, Jack said, but I'm not a diplomat and time is short, so let's speak plainly. By my count, you have at least two different paramilitary teams operating on your soil. That means your domestic security service has a problem. That problem could be incompetence, a mole, or something else entirely. I've never operated with the Shin Bet before, but their reputation is not one of incompetence, which means something else is at play here. I don't know what that something is, and I'm willing to bet you don't know either. But I suspect debriefing the captured American would help point you in the right direction. Give me the beacon's information, the woman said. We're perfectly capable of rescuing the professor without your help. I go with the assault team or you get nothing, Jack said. She may have been kidnapped on Israeli soil, but Becca has knowledge deemed critical by my government. I'm willing to bet that one of our special mission units is already heading this way, bringing the full weight and power of the United States with them. As soon as the wheels of their jet touch Ben-Gurion's runway, your role in this affair will be an afterthought. We can do this together right now, or you can watch as this becomes an American operation. Your choice. For a long moment, the woman said nothing. Even so, Jack had to force himself not to take a step backward under the weight of her fury. Courage was the only recourse when facing a lioness unarmed. A single hesitation, a single show of weakness, and all would be lost. The silence stretched as the woman tapped a slender finger against her thin lips. Then she spoke. A man with no last name and important friends walks into my house and demands my help, she said. Even Americans aren't usually this impudent. The woman's eyes widened. You look familiar. Jack with no last name, she said. But this is Israel, not America. I understand, Jack said. The woman nodded. Then who is this kidnapped American to you? Before this morning, Jack said, no one. Then why do this for someone you scarcely know? This time it was Jack's turn to pause as he considered his answer. As the words formed in his mind, his thoughts weren't of a professor who'd discovered something that might upset the world's balance of power. Instead, Jack was picturing chubby fingers wrapped around a battered action figure. Because it's the right thing to do, Jack said, locking eyes with the seated lioness.
You Americans, the woman said, shaking her head. Boy Scouts to the end.
All right, Jack, with no last name. You may accompany the rescue operation. Satisfied? Or would you like my answer written on official letterhead?
That won't be necessary, ma'am, Jack said, ignoring the woman's sarcasm. Your word is assurance enough. The woman waved a hand at one of the hovering technicians, and Jack provided him with the information needed to interrogate the beacon. The man verified Jack's instructions and then passed them to a bullpen worker. For several long seconds, the group waited in silence. Dudu nervously shifted from one foot to the other while Jack corralled his heaving stomach, trying to maintain his best poker face. Then the tech spoke.
We have the beacon.
Show me, the woman said. The image in the centermost screen blurred as the scale changed, zooming out and then centering on new coordinates. A moment later, the pixels steadied and the beacon's location appeared as a single pinpoint of cobalt, pulsing like an accusing finger. The woman laughed, while Jack swallowed a curse. Contrary to what he'd assumed, the beacon wasn't in Tel Aviv. It wasn't even in Israel.
Well, Jack, the American, the woman said, you're going on a trip. I'm sure you won't mind. No visit to the Middle East is complete without a stop in Lebanon.
Chapter 33.
What now? Jack said once the echoes of the woman's laughter had faded.
Now, the woman said, her lips still stretched into a smile. Now your American Special Mission Unit can try its hand at what passes for diplomacy in this part of the world. As far as the nation of Israel is concerned, this affair is now America's problem.
Jack swallowed, considering. On the map in the center of the room, the blue dot continued to flash, mocking him. Or maybe it was an indigo-hued lighthouse trying to warn him against dashing himself on dangerous rocks. In any case, it was clear from the woman's willingness to cede control of the entire fiasco that she had no desire to send forces into Beirut. Jack understood. In the annals of Israeli history, there were few cities as polarizing as Beirut. In the 7.6 square mile city of 2.2 million rested some of the Jewish state's most audacious successes, side by side with its most humiliating defeats. Beirut was where an Israeli commando team, led by a future prime minister, came ashore dressed as women and single-handedly brought justice. Justice in the form of bullets to the skulls of the terrorists responsible for the murder of defenseless Israeli athletes during the 1972 Olympics. In the same vein, Beirut was also the city that Israel had laid siege to and occupied at different times during the turbulent years since the Jewish state's modern founding. In the disastrous Second Lebanon War, which took place in 2006, Israel attacked Beirut's Rafik Hariri International Airport to support an invasion of southern Lebanon designed to uproot Hezbollah once and for all. Though perhaps a tactical success, the Israeli effort failed its strategic goal of ending Hezbollah's presence in Lebanon. At the war's conclusion, Hezbollah lived to fight another day, while several Israeli military and civilian leaders were fired or forced to resign. Lebanon's capital was just 147 miles from Jerusalem, a mere 15-minute flight by airplane. But to the Israeli people, Beirut might as well have existed in another universe. Still, Jack knew that he couldn't wait for SEAL Team 6 or the Army's Delta Force to show up and save the day. Time was of the essence, and every minute that Becca remained in the hands of her captors was an opportunity for her captors to discover the beacon, or even worse, move her beyond America's operational reach. Conducting a hostage rescue in Iraq or Syria was one thing, but going to war with Iran or China was something else entirely. Jack needed this woman to act now, while a rescue was still within the realm of the possible. Which meant he had to try a different approach.
The kidnappers who have Becca murdered a Shin Bet officer, Jack said. Will her death go unanswered?
You misunderstand me,
the woman said, her smile now gone.
Those who have harmed us will pay for what they did. But it will be at a time and place of our choosing. We are not the United States of America, Jack. We cannot afford to stumble into wars half-heartedly. Like your country, we were once proud. And like you, we were humbled. Our national humiliation took place during the Second Lebanon War. I will not authorize a mission just to sate our need for vengeance. We must be smarter than that. Not even if the men holding Dr. Schweigart represent a clear and present danger to the nation of Israel, Jack said. The woman frowned, her eyebrows narrowing. Once again, Jack found himself confronting a bird of prey.
Jack the American, the woman said, what are you not telling me?
Much. Jack said, just as I'm sure there's much you're not sharing with me. But there is one additional detail about Becca's kidnapping you might find interesting. Jack took a breath before continuing, as if to draw out the moment. He needed the woman's attention solely focused on what he was about to say. But that wasn't why Jack paused. Instead, he was summoning the required courage for what was to come. You have to pay to play. I have a picture of the intelligence officer who we believe targeted Dr. Schweigart, Jack said, pulling out his phone and scrolling to the picture Peter had provided. He was scheduled to meet her in Israel, right under the Shin Bet's nose.
Pictures of spies are nice, the woman said, and I would love to have this one. My internal security service is fearsome, but also fallible. If you're right, and a spy was operating undetected in our midst, I find that concerning. But a single spy unaccounted for is a far cry from a clear and present danger to my nation.
This man speaks English with an American accent, Jack said. He looks like a farm boy from Idaho. These traits are valuable for a cover operative. In your country, I'd say they're priceless.
What's your point? The woman said, her eyes narrowing.
My point is that you don't risk an operative with these unique qualities on a single operation, Jack said. My guess is that he's probably been to Israel before. Run this picture through your security databases. If there are no other hits, you have nothing to worry about. But if I'm right, then he's probably running other assets in Israel. Highly placed assets with information sensitive enough to justify an intelligence service sending their most valuable intelligence officer to debrief them. Tell me, ma'am, what Israeli national secrets do you think this farm boy from Idaho came to collect? This time the silence in the auditorium was absolute. The woman stared at Jack, her face blank. After a long moment, she nodded.
Give me the picture, the woman said, and we will run it. If it is as you say, I'll phone the Prime Minister and recommend the course of action you suggest. But if my analysts come back with nothing, you leave here empty-handed. Agreed?
Agreed, Jack said. Again, the woman waved her hand, and a technician materialized by Jack's side. Jack wiped off his phone before handing it over, and the technician bore it away with a reverence normally reserved for holy relics. The next several moments passed with excruciating slowness as Jack tried to maintain a self-assured expression, while his racing heart and churning stomach suggested otherwise. Then the technician returned. Heading directly for the seated woman, the man bent and whispered into her ear. The woman stared into the bullpen as she listened, her expression blank. After the man finished speaking, she offered a single nod before returning her attention to Jack.
Looks like you'll be getting a tour of Beirut after all, Jack the American. I hope you won't regret it.
Jack answered with the confident smile for which Ryans were known. And this was just as well, because words probably would have failed him.
There were many places he hoped to someday see. Beirut wasn't on the list. Chapter 34. The rush of wind through the Black Hawk's open doors should have felt refreshing. It didn't. Instead, the heavy, salt-tinged night air felt oppressive, like a wet blanket. For the past several days, the ocean had been taunting Jack, its green, foamy water beckoning. But now he would have been just fine standing on the beach and staring at the water from afar. Perhaps that was because the sea was less than 10 feet below the Black Hawk's tires. Jack had always considered flying Nap of the Earth in a helicopter something to check off his bucket list, but right about now he was rapidly coming around to his father's view of aircraft, namely, that they were best enjoyed from the ground. As if able to hear Jack's disparaging thoughts, the helicopter banked hard to the right. Jack found himself staring at nothing but frothing ocean as the blur of the rotor blades dipped to what seemed like just inches above churning swells. A particularly troublesome wave crested over the landing gear, drenching Jack in spray. Then they were straight and level again, though Jack's stomach begged to differ. "How are you?" Dudu said, screaming his words over the roaring wind and twin turbine engines providing the 2,000 shaft horsepower needed to keep the aircraft aloft. "Swell!" Jack screamed back. "Just swell!" For once, he was glad that he wasn't on a headset sharing the same channel as the aircraft's crew and the 10 heavily armed commandos strapped into the jump seats next to him. Even to Jack, his voice sounded a bit off. Tossing his cookies was one thing, but sounding shaken to a squad of unknown men you were about to follow into combat was unthinkable. Better to just unfasten his restraint harness and drop into the roiling ocean. 5 minutes, Dudu said, squeezing Jack's biceps as he shouted. 5 minutes to target. Jack nodded. This time he wasn't worried as much about his voice giving him away. Instead, he was terrified that if he quit gritting his teeth and clenching his stomach, the quick meal he'd wolfed down before boarding the helicopter would end up all over Dudu's shirt. What in the hell did it say about modern combat that Jack would rather be in a firefight with Hezbollah than sitting in this chopper? Or maybe that was part of the plan. If the ingress was rough enough, the assaulters would hit the ground looking for someone to throat punch. Based on the threat assessment Jack had received during the lightning-fast mission rehearsal, there would be no shortage of throats to punch. Assuming, of course, the rapidly maneuvering Blackhawk managed to get feet dry without plowing into a rogue wave. Then again, the alternative was even more stark. Since the disastrous Second Lebanon War, Beirut's Hezbollah occupiers had become a de facto nation-state of their own. Gone was the rudimentary militia armed with little more than AK-47s, RPGs, and a fierce devotion to Allah. Now the Shia terrorists employed the best technology their Iranian benefactors could provide. Russian next-generation thermal sights, anti-tank missiles, sniper rifles, and even shoulder-launched surface-to-air missiles were all commonplace in Lebanon. And those were just the armaments that Mossad had confirmed. More troubling were the rumors of Russian-made integrated air defense systems popping up across the city. Jack and his new friends weren't conducting a limited operation against a technologically overmatched foe. They were doing the equivalent of invading a nation-state, one potentially able to detect their approach and respond with aircraft-killing munitions, long before the pair of helicopters streaking over the water ever got close enough to discharge their cargo of killers. Hence, the Israeli pilots' attempt to turn their Blackhawks into speedboats. But the operation's success didn't depend solely on stealth. The Israelis firmly believed that the best defense was a good offense. Jack and the team of Sayeret Matkal commandos were not the only IDF assets sweeping in from the Mediterranean Sea. "Look," Dudu said, pointing toward the tablet strapped to his leg. "The diversionary force is inbound."
Jack hunched over the Shinbet officer's shoulder, watching as blue icons edged ever closer to the area bounded by operational graphics denoting their objective. Like much of Israel's defense tech, the handheld tablet was an improvement on an existing U.S. product. It showed a common operating picture that was a compilation of UAV footage and graphical overlays, along with the real-time positions of friendly aircraft and vehicles. In short, it allowed the user to watch an operation unfold, which, to be fair, was a good summation of Jack's role in this entire endeavor. Observer. "Are they F-35s?" Jack said, the blue icons captivating him despite his stomach's queasiness. "No," Dudu said, shaking his head.